This is the podcast for Thursday, March 3rd, 2011, Philosophy 203, Theories of Reality. So a couple of announcements. First is that there is a learning community reconnecting with nature, science, spirituality, and political activism. And so if you're interested in that, it's a learning community is when you have three courses, you have the same group of students taking that course, and the material is interrelated. And so this is all about religion, politics, and the environment. So if you're interested, I'll pass around this one sheet. And then if you think you're going to want to register the course, I think they got 9 spots left. And so if you'd like to do, you have to register for all 3 because that's the whole idea of the learning community. So if you're waiting till March 8th to register, or you got booted out of all your classes because you forgot to pay your bill or whatever, this might be a good deal for you. So I know sometimes the schedule's tough because I think each of these are 4-credit classes, so it is a full load. So anyway, if you're interested, maybe I'll leave these cards up here, but I'll pass it around. Let's start out today with a heartwarming tale of human agony and degradation.
Really?
When Angela McNulty spoke to a jury Thursday, she promised that, "I did not want my little girl to die." Strange considering that she starved, beat, and tortured her 15-year-old daughter, Jeanette Maples, for years until she died. The abuse and starvation was so bad, when the teenage girl finally collapsed from cardiac arrest, she only weighed 50 pounds. Friends and administrators remembered seeing Maples coming to school in torn clothes, and they'd sometimes catch glimpses of terrible bruises, yet somehow, despite reports of child welfare, the case was never investigated. Instead, for years, McNulty, and to somewhat lesser extent, her husband Richard, the stepfather, systematically starved and beat the girl while sparing the couple's 2 younger children for abuse. Well, besides being grossly underweight, when the girl finally died, she was bleeding from her brain from massive head injury, as well as hundreds of other injuries, many of them infected all the way to the bone. On the witness stand, the husband described how his wife would deny Maples food and water to the point that she would count the items in the refrigerator and keep locks on the cupboards. At one point, at least, Maples was forced to drink from the toilet in order to survive. When McNulty wanted to beat the girl, the husband told the jury she would just take Maples into what she called the girl's bedroom and do it there. Eugene Fire Captain Sven Valruz described in a hearing earlier this month how this was the most tragic event he ever fielded. "All I wanted to do was run," he said. "In 18 years, I've never cried about a call. I cried about this call." And there's several other reports about this, which include that she would basically take out all her frustration on the girl. At one point, after her daughter died, she told the police that maybe she should have taken up smoking cigarettes to get rid of her nervous tension. But instead, she would take her daughter into this room, and because the girl didn't really have a bedroom, she didn't even have a bed. She slept on the floor on top of a piece of cardboard, which was intended to keep the blood from staining the carpet. There was also blood spatter all over the walls in that room. When people hear about this and they think, okay, good, this woman's going to be punished for what she did, but then they think about, well, what about the husband? And it says that he may have participated in some small way in the abuse, but most of this is this woman with with a whip, whipping this girl over and over again, opening up wounds which are partially healed, all infected. Her back was a bloody mass, and all around her back, from her back down to her legs, was all bruises and scars which had been opened up and partially healed and opened up again. And again, she weighed 50 pounds. And you can see from that picture sort of better days. Yeah, you can see the kind of chubby cheeks there she has maybe before she was essentially beaten and starved to death over a period of years. And so people look at the husband, they think, okay, well, that obviously that this woman deserves to be punished severely for what she did. But what about the husband? Well, it seems like he's guilty too, right? Because he sat there and knew about the abuse and did nothing to intervene. So now, let me ask this question. If you would regard, I'll ask the class. What do you think about the husband in this case? He didn't do any of the beating himself. Yeah.
Is he the stepfather?
The stepfather. Does he bear any responsibility? What if there was a neighbor who heard the screams every night as they're going to, and they, like, instead of calling the police or making a report, they put in earplugs and slept with a fan next to their head to drown out the screams? What about the school officials that saw all the bruises? Would you have an obligation to report? Yeah.
I think it is, in my personal opinion, I think he's just as guilty as she is. However, I think the reason he didn't get in trouble was because he's just as much to blame as the state is for not investigating the case.
Well, he's going to go on trial. He's going to have his own trial, and he's going to face something.
I know that, but I think that after they said that the state didn't even investigate the house or whatever, I think that they're just as much to blame as he is, because they got actual warning about it, I think he's equally to blame as they are. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why they chose not to pursue.
Well, they did. That's not true, though. They're prosecuting him.
Oh, are they?
His trial's coming up. Yeah, do you have a comment? Anybody think the guy's completely innocent? Because let's assume, for the sake of argument, he didn't perpetrate any of the abuse whatsoever, that he never laid a hand on her or never did anything violent towards her at all.
I could argue it for him.
What would you say?
But if I wasn't morally obligated to choose what I really thought, I could argue for him the fact that if he really did love his wife, that the love for your wife could be more than that of someone else's kid. It's not even his kid, so he shouldn't technically even care nor intervene between mother-daughter relations, no matter how good or bad they are.
Even if she's being beaten to death? Suppose, like, you're...
Depends on where you come from, I guess, and how you were raised.
Well, so if you're raised, burn a cross, I mean, it's fine for you to go burn a cross?
I didn't say it was fine, but you might be led to say that you like burning crosses.
Right, well, I mean, so there's a difference between, like, how you're raised and what's, what's ethical and unethical, wouldn't you say? And let me just ask one more question. That's about, like, the morality of the husband. What if you're, like, you're a gun enthusiast and you're going off to your shooting club, and you got all your like firearms with you, and you're maybe walking out to your car, you notice one of your neighbors there. You're in an urban environment, and you're going out to the country to do some shooting. You get all your weapons. You're all, they're all locked and loaded. And as you're putting them in your car, you hear a voice coming from the alley. Help, help, right? And you see it, and you go there, and you see this woman, and she's being attacked by an assailant. And the assailant doesn't appear to be armed at all. But he's just, brutalizing this woman, and you're standing there with the gun that you're just about to put in the car. But then you look at your watch and you say, oh, if I don't leave now, I'm going to miss prime shooting time. And then you get in your car and leave and say, it's none of my business. What kind of person would you be? Or if you saw someone else do this,
one who didn't want to be prosecuted legally? I've personally read some reports of things like that, like security guards at a nightclub. Like a man and a woman were in an argument, the guy was beating the woman in the alleyway,
right,
and they intervened, and later in court, because they hurt the guy, trying to stop him from doing that,
right,
because they accidentally hurt him, just trying to protect her, they've had many instances where the woman turns around on the security guard and says, it was none of his business, he stepped off his own property, it wasn't even his job nor his business, and they got in trouble. So I could see where they would want not to do that. Not to intervene themselves, but I still think you should call the police. I mean,
okay, yeah. Suppose like the person who's being attacked, and the guy has said some things like, "When I saw you walking down the street, I knew I had to have you." And shut up. Like starts slapping her back and forth. So it's pretty obvious this is a random attack.
Maybe you even saw, like, you saw an APB for this guy, wanted, rapist, you know, and a list of his crimes and victims. So you know the guy's guilty, and you know the woman is innocent, and this isn't some sort of squabble. You have a gun in your hand, and you could easily just, you know, point. You wouldn't even have to shoot anybody. You just point it. The guy, let's suppose, there's no place you could reasonably hide a gun. And so you're reasonably, and you're, suppose you're a crack shot, and you're really fast. Well, what would be, would you have any obligation to act in this circumstance? Or would you be perfectly okay going off to your shooting club and saying, I want to get to my shooting club and drink beer and shoot my guns? What do you think about someone that acted in that fashion? They just went on their way. You think that the person would be, if a person had the ability to save someone from dire distress with little effort on their part, and did absolutely nothing, you think they're a pretty awful person, right? Just like, it's sort of like the stepfather, right? The stepfather is a miserable, rotten person. He was sitting there in his easy chair while he heard his wife beating this 15-year-old girl to death. He was hanging out there in the house and he saw the locks in the cupboards, and he saw his wife counting items in the refrigerator and say, "Did you sneak food again?" Go into your room and pick up like the scourge, and you know, and he heard her whipping in there, and he heard her, you know, maybe she didn't scream as much after a while, but he saw the blood stains on the wall. So you think that guy was like a horrible person. So now the question I'm leading up to is, you think her stepfather was bad. What about her heavenly stepfather? What about God, who could intervene but doesn't? God, who knows all and sees all and sees everything that stepfather saw, but doesn't lift a finger to help this poor girl and lets her die a horrible, agonizing death over several years. Thoughts? This is the problem of evil. If God is...
You can argue both sides, really.
If God's all-powerful, he's able to prevent it. If God is good, then he would want to prevent it. And yet, it was not prevented. Right? We have this idea of God. He's omnipotent. He's all-powerful. He's supposed to be the perfect goodness and a God of love and justice, and also a God of all knowledge and all power. But yet, you look at the world around us. This is just one event. So here's Time magazine. Here's a woman from Afghanistan. Her husband thought maybe she was two-timing her. And it seems like she wasn't. And he threw acid in her face. Totally ate her nose away. Women in Islamic countries have acid thrown in their face every day. Or they're brutally beaten by their husbands. And, you know, in America, the same thing. Americans are more into fists and blunt objects and less into acid. Acid seems to be a kind of Middle Eastern thing. But just horrible crimes. And today, things are actually pretty good for human beings. In the ancient world, it was even worse. And so the question is, if God is really our Heavenly Father, is he a neglectful or abusive parent? And if so, how can he be good? Or if he's not a neglectful and abusive parent, then he'd really like to help, but he can't, then is he really God? If he's impotent to intervene and stop things like this from happening, which again is multiply this by not just, you know, everything that happened this particular day, but everything like this that's happened in lesser indignities that have happened throughout all human history. And you get isolated stories of miracles, how, you know, God saved me from a fiery plane crash, right? Apparently he didn't give a damn with all the other people who were burnt to death and died horribly, but me, he miraculously saved me. I escaped with just a few cuts and bruises while everyone else was burned to death. And then you have this story, you know, man saved, a miracle, you know, and then you get some quotes from people saying, it was the Lord Jesus Christ that saved me from this plane crash. Meanwhile, you have the nun and the priest who were in the seat next to him, you know, were crushed by the fuselage as it, you know, when the plane came to a screeching halt on the runway. And so so you think about all the things that go on every day. Anyone else have a horrific story they've heard recently of something that's been in the news or some personal thing even if you want to share? something that's like you think, well, why would God allow that? Something that seems to be especially heinous, awful. Maybe something you've heard about in the past. Yeah.
I don't necessarily have a story, and I understand I kind of came in late in the conversation, but I just wanted to make the point that this planet is like a really gruesome place to exist. Like, imagine if you were a praying mantis and like during procreation afterwards the female bites the male's head off.
Right.
So like convert that into like this human experience. Imagine this new story of like this woman who decapitated her partner and like ate his head after they had sex. Like that would be elicit the same kind of reaction, I think, maybe a little bit different in this story because it's dealing with a child. But it's like we kind of live in this safety bubble of everything should be nice and good and safe.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that how a parent should behave, though? You know, if you have someone who's a parent, they let their kids sort of wander out and crawl out, or crawl around the sidewalk and crawl in the middle of the street. Wouldn't you think that's a neglectful parent, that they should do something to make sure their kid doesn't wander into the street or play with the fork in the light socket or something? You know, not even just like you think about, well, to be a minimally good parent, it seems that you'd at least have to not, like, you know, beat your children, right? Or do something bad to them. But still, you can be a bad parent if you don't prevent them from being harmed. Suppose you're looking for a babysitter and Michael Jackson is available, right? You gonna leave your kid with Michael Jackson?
Only thing I was out of it.
Now he's deceased. But you know, you think about, suppose like a guy comes to your next door, a guy comes to your house and says, "Hi, I'm your next door neighbor. I need to inform you that I'm a registered sex offender. If you want to go out to the movies with your sweetie, and you need to leave your kid with somebody." Are you leaving with that guy? I don't know. So, I mean, it seems like it's not, you don't have to, in order to be more responsible for doing something, you don't have to personally perpetrate the ill, right? So, suppose there's a devil. God can't really blame things on the devil, right? Because the devil only exists at God's good pleasure. He could wipe out the devil without a second thought if he wanted to, if he's omnipotent. If he can't take care of the devil, then he's not all powerful. If he doesn't want to take care of the devil, then he's not all good. Yet the devil, you know, in traditional Christian theology, exists. Or you can cut out the middleman and say, well, God's either doing or allowing all these horrible things to happen.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Is it more morally responsible to kill a severely retarded baby at birth or to let it live? And essentially have to exist in a world where it's only going to be supported by the state for so long before it then has to support itself, which is just not capable of doing. It's not going to have friends, it's not going to have family to take care of it once it like gets past a certain age.
Suppose I say no, it's not.
It's not. Well, is it? It's more morally responsible to let it live.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is that related to the discussion? You might say, well, why are there genetic defects? Why are people born with flippers for hands? And it's not like, you know, there's something in the water that makes people do that. Because people have been born with genetic defects throughout history before modern chemicals, and so it's not, you know, the chemicals that are causing people to get birth defects. Birth defects have been around since human beings have been around. And you go out to the rainforest and you find animals with, you know, three legs and extra, you know, vestigial limbs and defects who are born premature and so on. So it's a you might get some increase, but people, genetic defects are part of nature. And think about the food chain as a whole. And people have this idea that I had this one student in one of my other classes talking about all the wonders of God's creation, and he created the sunset, and he created the little furry animals, and he created the world for us to enjoy. Isn't this a great world that God created with all its beauty and majesty? And I said, well, you could look at it that way, or you could look at the food chain, which runs on fear and death and pain and need. You could think about all the little cold kitties who are freezing in these frigid temperatures, trying to find little burrows or places to shelter themselves. Or you could think about the gazelle who's being disemboweled while alive by the bloody maw of a lion. And the fact that this lion needs to feed on the warm flesh of living creatures in order to survive. And just, again, think about all the animals who have been eaten and eviscerated alive today. Apart from, like, human meat consumption. Just think about, and the whole idea of the food chain, that it's the law of the jungle, right? Kill or be killed. Think about the spider and the scorpion and the snake. If God created all creatures, great and small, he created those ones too. What kind of God would create a spider? And if you ever seen like the spiders are pretty gruesome creatures.
Camel spider.
And it's not just so sort of ugly, but they live out, they're sort of, they're the vampires of nature, right? And I remember one time I was a security guard, and I was hearing this intermittent sound. I thought there was a drip on the roof. It's pouring down rain. Really cold, and I'm like, what is that sound? And this kind of click, 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 kind of like that. What is it? It's not a drip. And finally, I found in the corner there was this spider web, and there was this little beetle. The little beetle was one of the little click beetles, and he was trying to get away, and the spider was spinning his web, and the little beetle wanted to live, and I was going click, 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 trying to get away. And finally, the spider went in and bit the beetle, and put in some venom or sucked out his blood or saved him for a snack for later or whatever, and that was the end of him. But you think about this sort of, that even though you have a kind of rudimentary animal, that click beetle has something like, has neurons, and so it's likely that the click beetle feels pain in the same sense that we feel pain. But God created the food chain, which runs on its predation, right? You have predators and you have prey. So, thoughts on this? What do you think? Could such a God who created a world like this be good? It would be one question.
Interesting.
If God exists, he could be good, I guess. It's all about checks and balances, I guess.
The reason we
have predators is to counteract overpopulation of prey.
Well, why do you get overpopulation?
Because there are no predators.
Why doesn't the population stabilize itself?
Because I don't know.
It seems like if I were God, I would make populations so that they would have some way, like you get a certain number, and they just they wouldn't make any more. There'd be the reproduction would be in equilibrium with production without having to worry about I want to have a certain number. I have the food source, right, and I have the animals. Overpopulation is when the number of animals that eat a certain thing becomes so large that they deplete the food source and then they're hungry, right? Well, it seems like somebody screwed up when they designed that system, right? And so what do you have? So you have like the predators, like what does God say? Oh, well, if I do that, there's going to be too many of them. So I know I'll create this thing with big, nasty teeth who will chase all these animals, pounce on the weakest, knock it to the ground, and eat it alive as it kicks and screams for its life. Imagine if some animal with like sharp teeth, like a rabid dog or something like that, had like bit into your belly and like chomped down and taken out a big hunk of flesh and then stuck its nose in there and started going like this, right? As you're kicking and trying to get away. I mean, this is a pretty horrific experience. And that's like, that happens hundreds of times a day. You have like the, think about your, anybody here have like cats? Right? If you're seeing like a cat with a mouse, they just love to. They take the mouse. They like to play with it. And you know, the cat probably doesn't know that the mouse feels pain. The cat's just doing what cats do. Play behavior is survival behavior. The games the animals play are all hooked into survival. And so it's sort of a kind of stimulation for what it needs to do in the wild to catch its prey. So like being really quick and be able to like reach out and rake and claw and grab. So my cat will like grab a roll of paper towels and like grab, sink in with both hands and then kick at it with its back legs. Or you have the little ball of string, right? And the cat bats it with his claws. Well, that's because when it catches a mouse, it's doing that same thing. If it's a mouse that might is sort of fast and might get away, it needs to be able to be really fast and catch it. And then once it catches like a mouse, and once the mouse is kind of injured and not moving too fast, the cat will play with it and rake it and claw it to death, sort of like this girl was treated, except for maybe not over a period of years, but over a period of hours, that the cat will basically torture the mouse to death. And then finally carry its corpse around its mouth. Who would design something like that? Would a god of love design something like that? It seems kind of hard to take. And then you think about this idea that God's supposed to be omnipotent and all-powerful. And so if I were God and I was going to make the world, I wouldn't have a molten subsurface. I might go with the nickel iron core. That might be all right. If I'm thinking about like what I'm gonna, what the Earth is gonna be like, I'm not gonna have like a bunch of tectonic plates floating on molten crust. Because what does that cause? Well, what happened in Christchurch in New Zealand? They had an earthquake, and they had buildings. And because it's so tough to live on planet Earth, human beings try to adapt. They do the best they can. So what do? They make houses. They make buildings. They build out of things that are available to them, wood and stone. And then what happens? Well, all the efforts they go to try to shelter themselves from the elements, from the driving rain, from the burning sun, from the bone-chilling cold. If you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, the earth starts shaking, all your buildings come down and crush you, right? So it seems like God either wants the buildings to come down. Maybe God enjoys seeing them shaking around and enjoys seeing people crushed. Or he kind of did the best he can, but he's kind of like an incompetent contractor that built a house that's kind of drafty in the winter and hot in the summer. So he's either incompetent or malevolent, it seems. Or maybe indifferent. Yeah.
Me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, not to get too religious, but...
Well, be as religious as you want.
But ever since we took that fruit, we were kind of banished from this perfect garden, and ever since then, we've been kind of on our own. So if you want answers to your little question, just got to look in Genesis and see the reason why. I mean...
What was the fruit?
It doesn't say. It's more of an abstract story, I think.
Right.
Like,
so, I mean, that's supposed to go with, like, the literal garden story, right? So, God created human beings in a paradise. It's kind of weird. You think about God creates all the animals, and it describes all the different kinds of animals. It seems like you still got the snakes and the creepy things, the reptiles. What the lion didn't have fangs. There were no predators. So, I mean, it seems like you still get the problem with animal pain there. But leaving that aside, human beings... The first two human beings made a choice, and everybody else has been paying for it ever since. Well, why should I be blamed for what Adam did?
Because I think this is like a, best way I can put it is like this is kind of like a learning program for us, and we are learning how to be perfect. And I mean, it doesn't come easy. I mean, we can't just be handed something. It's like teaching a man to fish. You know, we gotta grind it out and become gods ourselves, I guess.
Well, why do you have to suffer to advance?
Because that's how you learn.
It seems like suffering is a tough way to learn. There's like you can either learn through acquiring knowledge or mimicking a person who does things well, or you can learn through experience, which means making a bunch of mistakes.
I think that's how everyone learns.
Well, do the mistakes have to be that severe? In other words, in order to learn that I should that it's bad for me to rob, steal, and kill, do I need to go to prison? There's plenty of people that have learned not to do that who haven't been to prison. So it seems like even if God thinks that maybe a little bit of suffering is necessary to learn certain lessons.
What did Jeanette Maples have to do to learn a lesson? What was your lesson to learn?
Yeah, that's a good question. What do you learn by being beat to death? What do you learn by having acid thrown in your face?
What do you learn by
looks are overrated. I shouldn't be too concerned with my physical appearance. And now God's taught me that I shouldn't be vain because he took away my nose.
Well, I think I learned something. If I see bruises, I'm going to remember that story. I'm going to make sure that doesn't happen again to people in my community, I mean.
But the only reason that piece of information is useful to you is because that happens all too often in a world that God has allowed to continue.
Then we got some serious issues with our society then, and we need to...
Well, is it our issue?
Why is it our responsibility? Why doesn't God do something about it?
Yeah, why doesn't God do something about it? He's our creator.
Instead of trying to, like, fit our world into the conception of God, why not try and fit our conception of God into the reality of our existence? And, like, not that... We have... There's just this weird assumption about this Judeo-Christian God that seems to permeate everyone in this country's concept of God. That, like, we have no basis except, like, myths perpetrated by, like, decades of clergymen unto their congregation, you know?
Yeah, I mean, this is a sort of attack on the Judeo-Christian concept of God. The problem of evil is a problem for the Judeo-Christian concept. And maybe attack's a strong word, but the problem of evil is only a problem for a God who possesses the attributes of omnipotence and omniscience and omnibenevolence. Yeah.
Well, I think the reason that they portray God as an all-loving, awesome, amazing God is because who wants to follow a cruel God?
How about a realistic?
How many people like the devil? How many people?
Several.
Like, how many people want to worship the devil versus God?
Many, probably.
I mean, people
why aren't there more?
Not very high percentage, though.
Yeah, there are some who would rather worship the devil than God, but who outweighs the other?
I think that our cultural, like, belief by fear is kind of what drives us to believe in God. Like, because you're supposed to fear and respect them and know that something that's definitely not the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think fear is anything that you should have for someone who's supposed to be all powerful and all knowing.
That's how we're run as well. I mean, what is the only thing that keeps us from doing bad things is the fear of prosecution.
Well, like it says in the Bible that perfect love casts out fear. Fear involves the threat of punishment, but perfect love casts out fear. But so you think, God loves me, so I shouldn't be afraid. I shouldn't be afraid of him. But the thing is, well, maybe I should be afraid of the things that he created. And it sets you to wondering, well, what sort of God is he who's created a world like this? See, could somebody turn down the light in front here? Somebody close to the lights.
Doesn't the Bible also say that God is a wrathful God?
That's true. You look at particularly, not just in the Old Testament, also the New Testament. So the problem of evil takes the form of an inconsistent triad. So you have three propositions, all of which cannot be true at the same time. So the first one is God is omnipotent. God has all power. God can do anything it's logically possible to do. So God is omnipotent. Not omnipotent, it's omnipotent. Have you ever heard Handel the Messiah? You can hear the word pronounced correctly. God is also good. Sometimes it's called omnibenevolent. So God not only has all power, but he's supposed to be not only morally good, but the ground of moral goodness and the source of all moral goodness. Yet, it also seems that evil exists. That human suffering primarily, but you might also think of other things, like there might be forms of evil which don't necessarily involve suffering. So you might think that human degradation, for example. So there, if you think about a woman who has no economic opportunities and lives in poverty and is forced to live as a prostitute, say. So, and in an unwilling fashion. So there's some women that see prostitution as you know, particularly these high-class call girls, maybe that Charlie Sheen has at his Hollywood parties, right? maybe they're okay with the hooking. But there are a lot of people, particularly in third world countries, who are forced into prostitution, sometimes by their parents, sometimes through economic circumstance and lack of opportunity. And so in addition to like the pain and suffering and the mental anguish, you also get this idea that you have a person being degraded. And so maybe you could think about that as kind of a form of suffering, or sorry, a form of evil, which might not involve mental or physical suffering, or might be considered separately from it. So if God's omnipotent, it seems he'd be able to prevent evil, right? Because if God's omnipotent, he can do anything. If God could have created the world any way he wanted to, he didn't have to create tectonic plates that are moving and shaking and knocking all our buildings down and crushing people to death. He didn't have to create extremes of heat and cold where you have only very few places, a few South Sea islands and maybe some places in the highlands of Ecuador where it's perpetual spring. Most places you get some pretty extreme forms of weather. You know, I used to live in Santa Barbara, and if I were God, I would create the world kind of like Santa Barbara. And maybe I'd create some sort of these ski slopes and some kind of colder places for people to go vacation. But most people, they like, you know, temperatures varying from 65 to 75, a little bit of rain in the wintertime to sort of make the grass grow. But most of the time, it's, the sort of mild temperatures. But no, you have, Alaska, the frigid north. You have the boiling tropics. You have the stifling humidity of the deep south of the United States. And then you have, the desert. And just, most places on the earth are not habitable without the help of modern technology. Or even, some form of technology. Shelter, you have to build houses. Now, it's kind of interesting that when European settlers first came across Samoa and some of these South Sea Islands, they were aghast at the fact that people didn't have to work for a living. They would just hang out and they would eat the fruit off the trees. They wouldn't wear clothes because, hey, it's too hot for that. So they just walk around naked and they would swim in the ocean, pick some fruit off the trees. Maybe they have like a little hut and maybe some, beds made of straw. And every once in a while they'd get a little hungry. They're like, hey, let's go on a pig hunt. And they go hunting for wild boars, and they'd have a big party. And life was one big party. And these settlers who were, puritanical Christians thought, this is terrible. People not having to work for a living, walking around naked, laying in the sun all day, and just goofing off. We got to do something about this. Put some clothes on those people. Get them reading the Bible and feeling ashamed of their nakedness and sorry for their sins. But what I would do is I would create a world like that, which is sort of the sort of Garden of Eden type world. But the world is very unlike that. So this doesn't even speak to the way human beings mucked out. This is the way the world is designed. Why do we have these extreme? Why is it there's only a very few places which are ideal for human habitation? Well, you got a big rock which is tilting on its axis and spinning like a top. And so, obviously, on the poles, it gets really, really cold. In the middle, it gets really, really hot because it has to do with the relationship to the sun. And there's only a few kind of Goldilocks zones, like Santa Barbara, the French Riviera, Cotacachi in Ecuador. And that's and those are pretty much it as far as, the really nice places to live. If you like it a little warmer, maybe the LA area. And why is it that if you look at a map and you look at the population centers, everybody wants to live in the coast? Well, it's because you have milder temperatures. And that's why look at Wyoming. Who the hell wants to live in Wyoming? Like it's like a they got three they got 3 electoral votes or something like that, because nobody lives in Wyoming. So evil does seem to exist. And we just, again, covered a few examples. And you think about things like disease and age and death. Think about, like, I don't know if you've ever had, anybody ever here ever have to have, like, a root canal?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's a... Did you maybe have, like, infected tooth? Or was it just... Well, how would you describe the pain?
Not very fun.
Like, I had infected tooth, and you know, part of it's, I take responsibility for not, you know, making sure to brush my teeth every night. But why do I have to brush my teeth every night before I go to bed? Why, if I don't, you know, take this, toothbrush and toothpaste and scrub all my teeth down, that bacteria will grow and eat my teeth alive? Like, if I was God, I'd, like, everybody would be like Jaws from the James Bond movie. They'd have, like, steel teeth that would never erode. Why this enamel that can be eaten away by bacteria? But this is, like, the most unpleasant experience you can imagine. It's usually intermittent, too. So you get, like, the bacteria gets in there and it eats. And, you know, God made that bacteria, right? So, and it eats into the tooth enamel and it gets down to the root. And that root is all those nerve endings there. And God made those nerve endings, too. And you'd just be laying there in bed, you turn around, all of a sudden, like, the most stabbing, jarring pain you've ever felt in your life. And it's so bad, you start whooping, you go, ah, like that. And you think, oh, God, I hope it stops. Then you go to a dentist and he picks you up. Dr. Backer in Cosgrove does good work. But think about world without dentistry. What would you do? You'd get like a rock or a long stick or a stick and a rock, and you'd have to punch it out. Imagine what that would feel like. I don't know if you've seen Castaway with Tom Hanks.
An ice skate and a coconut.
There you go. Well, you wouldn't have an ice skate, right? But you'd have a coconut and a stick or something. Or you try to tie a thread around it and yank it out. And probably it would take a while to do, and just would be incredibly painful. And we don't think about, you know, anesthesia has only been around for 100 years. Novocaine was discovered in the 19th century. Antiseptic surgery was discovered in the 19th century. Penicillin, I mean, things we take for granted today. But that God didn't create those things. We had to figure those things out. And for all of human history, up until the middle of the 19th century, you know, what did you have to dull the pain? Alcohol, maybe some willow bark tea. Not a lot. So that's the problem of evil in a nutshell, and we'll look for some possible solutions after the break. So we have a pretty good, what do kids in America worry about? Passing their math, you know, doing well in their math class, maybe being, you know, kind of bullied by classmates, or whether the girl at school likes them or not. And what do kids growing up in Ethiopia have to worry about? Being eaten by a vulture as they try to crawl to some place where there might be some food or somebody to help them. So here, I'll post this to the forum for people who are listening on the podcast. So there you see that vulture is waiting for his meal. And of course, God created the vultures too, right? What do the vultures eat? They eat dead things. If people didn't die and animals didn't die, there would be nothing for the vultures to eat. But why did God create death and the vultures, and, you know, and why isn't God doing anything about this? The photographer who took this afterwards, he actually helped this kid out. What if the photographer, like, spent like a couple of hours taking different angles of this kid and say, oh, this is going to be the Pulitzer, you know, and then, like, went off and didn't do anything, and just let this kid be eaten by the vulture? Wouldn't he be a pretty awful person? But look, God could step in and help that little kid anytime he wanted to, even before his ribs start sticking out and his belly started descending from malnutrition. A large number of kids die of essentially diarrhea every year. Before they reach the age of 5, they get, you know, dysentery is the name you usually use for it. But it's basically, you have contaminated water supply because you don't have modern chlorination, and you don't have clean water sources. And so you have kids dying of intestinal bacteria, and they die of dehydration. which is a pretty horrible way to die, and they can't even keep down water. And it just goes through their system, and they lose too much fluid, and they end up dying because they're young and they haven't developed an immune system. Why do we need immune systems? Because there are all these bugs trying to kill us. At every moment in your life, this computer keyboard especially, right? The stupidest thing I could do today, well, I mean, it's probably a lot of stupid things I could do, but one of the stupid things I could do would be like to rub my hand all over this keyboard and then go like that and lick my own hand, right? Or even like just pick my tooth, right, with this fingernail. You realize how much bacteria you have underneath your fingernails. And why do you get sick? Do you think it's just random? No, there's just bacteria all over the place, and they're trying to invade your body. And then when you get sick, the symptoms of like the snot running down and your throat being all raw, a lot of that is your body trying to kill these bugs, which are trying to eat you from the inside out. They're trying to take over your body, and your body fights back, and so it sends in all this mucus to try to flush out your sinus cavities. And you're coughing. Why? To get all that crap out of your throat. So that's your body's defense mechanism. Why? Because God created these little bugs that go around and eat things, including people. So what do you? Let's come back here. Any thoughts on the kid with the vulture?
The better question is, why do the societies like that continue to breed when they see it, like every day? And maybe they were in that position. Mm-hmm. But by just some dumb luck, they survived old enough to procreate.
Well, you're living out in the desert without a PlayStation, without, you know, there's not a lot to do.
It's like
everybody's got to have a hobby.
It's the desire for life to exist, it, like, overcomes any, like, tragedy you could possibly imagine that comes along with existing in this life. Just like the desire to be sexual, which then, I mean, essentially means procreating. So it's the desire to procreate, essentially.
Right, and we have technology.
Not humans to procreate, but like the DNA to continue its existence.
Right. If you think about this sort of from a biological point of view, you're kind of the means of your genes to perpetuate themselves. And after you reach prime reproductive age, your DNA doesn't give a damn about you, and it starts falling apart. And so, you know, nature is done with you once you're past your reproductive era, and that's why, you know, decay and your body starts breaking down, and you start reaching middle age, and, you know, like I got the gout. I thought gout was like some weird disease that like rich French people got from eating rich food. I still have no idea how I got it. I know it was like really painful, and it's why, you know, I'm a vegetarian, and you may need to lose some weight, but, you know, why is it so hard to pack out, to keep the weight off when you get older? Your metabolism slows down, you don't burn off calories as efficiently, and, you know, and you're hungry, and it's not like I eat a lot. I eat till I'm full. Why is it that America is getting fatter and fatter? Well, it's because we got plenty of food. And when you have plenty of food, you eat till you're full, and then some of it has to do with what you eat. But your body craves a certain number of calories, and there's even some people that there's a chemical called leptin in your body, and some people have more or less of it, and that regulates appetite too. So that's why some people they're just not hungry very much at all. Other people have ravenous appetites. And then there's some people with faster metabolisms than other people, too. But generally speaking, what are the things that taste really good to us?
Sweet.
Fat. Sweet, right? This really sweet and really fat things. Big cuts of meat, right? A big
French
juicy
fries.
Steak. French fries, right?
That gets my mouth watering right there. It's weird.
What about a carrot, though? One of those nice, crunchy carrots? Or a stick of celery.
Steak sounds good.
Or maybe some granola. Right? You're like, see you every once in a while. Maybe I'll have a few carrots with my steak, you know, for a little variety, but it's not like you crave carrots. But things like blueberries and carrots and, like, you know what's really good for you? Alfalfa sprouts, right? But any of you ever eaten, like, alfalfa sprouts with anything on it? It's pretty hardcore if you do that. But you usually have to dress them with a bunch of oil and dressing. But those things are wheatgrass. Wheatgrass is really good for you. Or there's this thing, I don't know if you've seen the Odwalla Superfood. It kind of looks like this green sludge. It's like all this stuff mixed in
there. Yeah, it looks gross. And it tastes gross, too.
And I've kind of got used to it. You can learn to like everything, like anything after a while. But that's the stuff that's really good for you. But, you know, when you think about, if I could add anything today, you know, what would I want? You think, like, ice cream, ribs, you know, those are things that are really good. And that's because nature has made you so that you crave the fat and the sweet. Why is that? Well, because those are really good, dense forms of energy. And this is from our evolutionary history when, you know, that you would, human beings evolved as omnivores and you want lots of energy because there's going to be a time of famine. You want to have stored energy around the middle for the lean times so you don't starve to death. So when the food riots start, I'm going to feel sorry for the rest of you, but I'm prepared. I think I can last at least 3 months without even cutting into my muscle tissue. But the rest of you are going to just be SOL.
I got about 2 days.
But you know, that fat storage is sort of, but then what happens by the time you reach middle age, you know, when you're eating all that fat, fattening food and all that sugar, what does it do? It coats your arteries with plaque. And then the openings get smaller and smaller and smaller, and pretty soon it's like, you have the first heart attack, right? Or you have a stroke or something. And you could be dead by the time you're 50. And so, but you think about, if and I were God, I designed the world where people did things which were good for them and avoided things which were bad for them, or I'd just make human beings that were indestructible who could do what they wanted. You know, why do we have these fragile little bodies with all these things that can go wrong with them? And why is it that the things which are good for us are things which are, or which we find pleasurable are often things which are in the long term harmful to us and vice versa? Let me just come back to my PowerPoint. I'll just leave that in the air for a moment. And another version of the problem of evil. So we talked about like the inconsistent triad. So this is sometimes called the logical problem of evil, which is that this is a formal inconsistency. So all three of these statements, God is omnipotent, God is good, and evil exists, can't all be true at the same time. So one of them has to go. Either God is good and evil exists, but he wants to prevent evil, and he just can't because he's impotent. God is all powerful, and evil exists, but he's not good. He's either sort of beyond good and evil, or both good and evil, or neither good nor evil. But God isn't morally good, and we're mistaken about that. God is both omnipotent and good, but we're mistaken about this idea that evil exists. And maybe we don't really understand. Evil is an illusion of some sort. And that's kind of like the Christian Scientists and mystics have that, they go with that third option often.
Maybe God is evil.
Well, I mean, that's the other possibility, that God is, he's either incompetent or malevolent, is one way of looking at it. Either God tried to make the world good and he screwed up and we end up with this lousy world, or he made the world exactly like he wanted it, and it causes lots of suffering because that's the way he intended it. So there's the probabilistic version says, well, it's not like you have a formal contradiction that all these three things can't be true. They might be true. It's just highly unlikely. So the idea is that, you know, imagine like a world where everything is sweetness and light, and it's like the Garden of Eden. But one day, one person after 1,000 years wakes up with a hangnail. And they're like, what's this? It kind of hurts a little bit. And then they pull it off and they say, ouch. And the first expression of pain is uttered. And then it heals up in 5 seconds. And it goes on, you go on with perpetual pleasure and happiness. And sweetness and light and on indefinitely. Would that prove there wasn't a God? Probably not. So the idea is that you could imagine a world much better than this one. And at a certain point, even you might think, well, suppose like the world was like Leave It to Beaver, right? Or like the sort of idyllic sitcoms where, you know, that you have these kids who have problems with like doing well in school and trying to, you know, raise, you're trying to make the sports team or whatever. They have just sort of, you know, mundane kind of quaint little problems. But they have problems, right? But it's not like, you know, Josh, Dad, I have a problem. You know, oh, Timmy, what is it? You know, the listening father, and he's like, the next door neighbor molested me, right? And he's like, and it's like, and the father says, well, you're used to it because I do that every night, right? You don't get like, they don't have the problem with like, you know, spouse abuse and molestation or, you know, people being raped and killed, and you know, if there's theft involved, it's usually some sort of petty thing. Somebody stole the prize. Somebody ate some birthday cake they weren't supposed to, or something. But you know, it's not those problems aren't like the real problems that people face day to day. They sort of, but there is a sort of, there are some people that seem to live charmed lives. They live in suburbia. They're middle class. Their folks have a lot of money. They seem to figure out by modeling their parents all the things they should do, and they have little disappointments. But mostly their life is pretty good. Most people's lives aren't like that, particularly people that live in places outside of America. But even people inside of America end up with problems. So you have, just to mention a few of the things you have, which seem to render the existence of a benevolent God highly unlikely. We talked about some of these: disease, old age, hurricanes, earthquakes, floods, and the suffering of animals. And then you also have moral evil, so suffering caused by the intentional acts of human beings. And then even this, you think, well, is God responsible for moral evil? And that's one where you might say, well, God wants to give human beings free will. To have the free will, you need the freedom to do good as well as evil. But that doesn't really address this natural evil problem of the things which seem built into the system. So, I mean, one way of looking at the problem of evil, or asking about the problem of evil, is why do bad things happen to good people, and why do good things happen to bad people? So maybe suffering is okay if the person really deserves it. Okay. If you've seen the movie Unforgiven, there's a scene where the green wannabe outlaw shoots some guy. I mean, he's not a wannabe outlaw. He's a wannabe gunslinger. He finally shoots his first person, and he like throws up, and he's like all upset about it, and says, he had it coming. And Clint Eastwood's character says, we all have it coming, kid. So you might think that all human beings are bad, you know, through and through. And I suppose if that's one way to go, right? Original sin, we all deserve all this punishment we get. But you think about, you know, little babies, and they seem innocent, and people who seem like the kindest, gentlest people that go around and try to help people, like those missionaries that were going out trying to get Bibles and spread the gospel to the Muslims, pirates. And they end up being besieged by pirates and killed. You have a bunch of people going up to the mountains to worship God, and the church bus goes off to a ravine, right? You're thinking, well, what, they picked the wrong God? Why wasn't God looking out for them? So I gave you some excerpts from the story of Job, which deals with the problem of evil from a Jewish and also, you know, by extension, Christian perspective. So at the beginning of Job, God has a bet with Satan. God's bragging about his servant Job, saying, look at how my servant Job serves me. And Satan says, well, he's just doing that because you give him all this great stuff. Take away all this stuff, and Job will curse you. And God says, okay, Satan, you got a bet. So Satan takes away all Job's children and his other possessions. And the children are sort of treated like possessions. So roving nomads, I think, kill off all his camels. And a hurricane comes and takes the roof off his house and kills all his kids. And basically everybody dies. God decides to give Job special punishment by leaving his wife alive. and she nags him as he's sitting on the ash heap of his house, and finally gets some sort of oozing sores, and she says, "Why don't you just curse God and die?" And Job,
one of his punishments was keeping his wife alive.
Yeah, so it's not in the text, but that's my theory anyway. That the reason why the wife doesn't die is because God and or Satan realize it's going to be worse with for Job if the wife is still around. Why don't you just curse God and die? Right? Probably said it like that. And so she urges a quick death. Maybe Job, being married to this woman, maybe Job was looking for a quick death before. We don't know. So Job has some sort of horrible skin disease. So essentially, Satan says, "Hey, he's still got his health," and God says, "Okay, take that away too." So Job is just utterly personally destroyed. He's lost everything, and look, the hands on the hip. I love this portrayal there. It's sort of the henpecked husband. I like the way these Middle Ages. You get this these Middle Ages paintings. They always portray people in contemporary garb. This is kind of weird.
Why is he naked?
I think he actually, the story says he's naked. You know, he's one of the things you do. You'd like, if you were like in a bad way in the ancient world, you'd tear your clothes off and, you know, curse God and hope to die. And so I think that's his deal. He doesn't have even the clothes off his back, I guess. So he's lost everything. Here's a illustration by the guy, the illustration, the cover of the textbook, William Blake. And what does Job say? "The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." So God gave me all the stuff, and so it's his, so he can take it away if he wants. Now all of his friends say, "You must have done something to tick God off." Right? So and Job protests his innocence. He says, "Look, I've done my best to be a good person. I don't have any sins, secret sins. There's no reason why God would be upset with me and be punishing me." Job remains faithful. There's the wife again with the hand on the hip. And here's Satan here dropping something on his head, or who knows, punishing him. And finally, he says, "If God were to come down right now, I'd give him a piece of my mind." And then God appears in the story. And God answers Job from the middle of a whirlwind. So what... someone want to paraphrase what God has to say to Job? What's God's answer about why Job is suffering? Does he say, "Hey, I had a bet with Satan that, you know, if Satan worked you over, that you'd finally cry uncle and you'd curse me, but you did a pretty good job and passed the test, so good work."
That's stupid.
What does he have to say? Do you remember how would you paraphrase? Does he pat Job on the back and tell him he's did a good job, that he passed the test? He doesn't tell him anything about how this happened, like why any of this stuff happened, right? As a matter of fact, he just gives it a big long lecture. "Where were you when I created the world? Can you tell me how you created the stars and all these different kinds of animals?" And Job's like, and he says, "I repent in dust and ashes. I have declared things too wonderful for me to know." And so he doesn't know what to say. And he says, "I'm sorry for even questioning you." And then God rewards him and replaces all his dead kids with new ones and makes it all better and replaces all his other possessions. And Job lives happily ever after. He even gets like twice as much stuff, like, as he had before. Twice as many kids, twice as big a house, twice as many animals. And so, what's the lesson from Job here? This reiterates what I just said. God lectures Job for daring to question him. Job repents, acknowledges his ignorance before God, and then God rewards him. And so there's sort of this idea that life's a test, and if you remain faithful, God's going to reward you at the end. That seems to be one of the themes of Job. It's just that when suffering comes along, it's some sort of a test. And God, if God told you why you were suffering, it would ruin the test.
God points a lot.
Yeah. So you get this big long lecture, and it's essentially, I'm God and you're not. If you're going to like paraphrase what God's lecture to Job, I'm God, I'm in charge. It's my world. I created it. You're just an insignificant insect in the larger scheme of things, and you don't try to lecture me on how to be God. But then he says, you did better than your friends who were telling you must have sinned. So he actually has some bad things to say about Job's counselors or comforters, who actually are as much help as his wife was. So one thing, one of the ways you could look at it is this sort of idea, I call this the human ignorance theodicy. So a theodicy is an attempt to get God off the hook for evil, or an attempt to solve the problem of evil in its own terms. So theodicy is a believer's attempt to try to explain why evil exists. And acknowledging that those three statements are true. Yes, God is omnipotent. Yes, God is good. And yes, evil exists. Here's how all three of those things can be true. That's what a theodicy does. And so this human ignorance theodicy just says, well, all three of those statements are true, but we can't really understand how they can all be true. That God has his reasons for allowing women to have acid thrown in their face, for little babies being raped on videotape, or people being flayed alive, pregnant women being stabbed to death by crazed Manson cultists in order to try to start a race war. Which is the whole helter-skelter thing. Charles Manson told his followers to do something witchy, right? And they're all on drugs, and so they go out and they find a bunch of white movie stars. Sharon Tate, beautiful movie star, nice human being, and she's like 8 months pregnant. And one of the guys, basically gutted her. And I think one of the people, I can't remember if it was her, I think she was stabbed and hanged, and one of the people who was killed said, "You can't kill me; I'm already dead." So you think about the sort of state of mind you'd have to be in to say something like that. So it's a pretty horrific, bloody murders. And again, like think about that's just like a blip on the radar screen compared to all the other horrific things that have ever been done throughout human history and continue to be done, right? Right now, I'm sure there's someone rotting away in a Mexican jail, a Turkish prison, for something a crime they didn't commit. There was a guy, another jihadi in Germany, a homegrown one. Guy grew up in Germany, under the influence of radical clerics, decided to kill a bunch of American servicemen shouting, Allahu Akbar, God is great. Just digging just one small thing. So the human ignorance theodicy says we shouldn't question God's decisions. We should just trust and obey. And then again, there's this other idea that life is sort of a test, and if God gave away the answers, we wouldn't learn from the test. And so the answers are necessarily hidden from us. So what do you think about this as an explanation for the problem of evil?
I think that we've kind of narrowed our options to, like, debating the logical consistency of the literal translation of the Bible.
Well, I mean, this isn't just necessarily a biblical thing, although I like using this biblical story. But the general idea is that there's a reason why all these terrible things happen. It's just that human beings are sort of like children, right? You take your kid to the dentist, and your kid can't understand why they have to go to the dentist, or you take them to the doctor, and they're like poking them with needles and you know, and he's got to take these pills. And like, for example, here's a great example. My nephew got leukemia when he was like, I think, 3 years old, right? So, and first of all, they accused my my brother of child abuse because he had all these fractured bones. And one of the things that leukemia does is it fractures your bones. So first, my brother had to deal with the possibility of, like, you know, going to prison for abusing his kid, who he loves and would never touch. And then the doctors finally figured out, aha, he hasn't been beaten up by his father. It's like all those other kids we saw last week. It's leukemia. And so then they started some treatment. But, you know, he's got to get the spinal tap, which is a pretty gruesome procedure, extremely painful. He's got to have all this blood drawn. He's 3 years old. He doesn't understand why. But the idea is that there's a reason the doctors know. But he really can't understand it. You could try to explain it to him, but a three-year-old's not going to get it. And the argument is, well, we're like three-year-olds. We're like three-year-olds when it comes to the meaning of existence and why there's evil. And in order to understand it, we would have to have God-like knowledge, which we don't possess. But someday God's going to explain it to us. Or God, we're going to be in a place where God's going to allow us to understand it. Yeah.
Well, I think that as well, our role is to try to understand it. And that's really the meaning of life, is to overcome sin or become masters of the universe or whatever. I mean, it's the same thing in my view.
So, I think those are different things. So overcoming sin is like repenting and either having God forgive you. Being a God yourself, that's like a different deal.
I think they're the same.
Spiritual development.
I think they're the same thing. I mean, I put in the moral evil in there too, like all these earthquakes. I mean, why do we have earthquakes? Why can't God stop it? Well, if we're gonna control the universe someday, we gotta start at the beginning. Like, hey, how do we deal with earthquakes? You know.
Well, why doesn't God just make us the way He wants us at the end? Why does He make us go through all this?
Because it's a learning process. I think.
Why didn't God create us with the knowledge already? You need to learn just because you're ignorant. Why did God create human beings as being ignorant?
Well, I mean, it was our choice to take that fruit and be banished.
It wasn't my choice.
Well, I mean, you're human.
If you believe the story, it's, you know.
If God can see everything, He would have known that we were going to take the fruit, so why even put it there?
I mean, why do we have kids, and why do we send them off in the world without, you know, being, you know, parenting them all the way through? Why do we let them, you know, get tickets when they first drive their car? Or, like, you know, why can't we just babysit them the whole time, you know, and make sure they don't drink? I mean, they gotta learn their own way so they can become men.
Isn't that kind of God's fault, though? For, like, you know, you look at some animals, like fish, the egg hatches and the fish starts swimming around doing all the things adult fish do. They don't have to be taken care of like human infants, you know. You gotta wait till they're 5 years old so they can kind of even walk around and take care of themselves a little.
Yeah, I think I saw a documentary where they're saying that human children are actually the most vulnerable of all the animals on Earth.
You had your hand up earlier.
I was wondering how the story of Job, why God needs to prove Satan wrong.
Yeah.
And he's omnipotent, you know. Like, he should know, like, already that he's right. You know.
Seems like kind of a jerk.
Isn't he kind of prideful too about Job?
Yeah.
With his bragging, and isn't that a sin? Pride. Isn't gambling?
Yeah. Well, like, I was talking with one of my friends at the bar, and we're like talking about our wives, and he's like, my wife, she's just like the most awful woman. She doesn't cook, she doesn't clean, she, you know, doesn't do what she's told. And I say, well, you know, you should see my wife. She's like, she just makes these beautiful 5-course meals and takes care of me, keeps the house spick and span, and the bedroom, that's like the best part. And she's just this wonderful woman, and kind, and she soothes my brow when I get home and pats me on the head when I tell her all my problems and never complains. He's like, oh yeah, well, that's just because, you know, you're pulling down that good salary as that philosophy professor, making lots of money, and you have that nice house and you buy her lots of stuff. That's why. And I say, well, I got a bet for you. I bet you that if I told her that you would be my proxy husband for a week, you could you could beat her, you could berate her, you could do whatever. And I bet when I came back, she's like, oh, I'm so glad you're back. And she wouldn't even complain about the fact that I subjected her to you for a week. Right? You gotta be a pretty awful thing to do, right? Like, as a that's essentially what God does, isn't it? That he's like, he creates a problem by bragging, and then he wants to prove something to Satan as a sort of gentleman's wager. And Job is the pawn in the whole thing.
Why does God prove anything to anyone?
Yeah.
That's a good question. Yeah.
I think that if these stories came about today, like, say, if the people who wrote the stories in the Bible were alive during our time, and they were recounting these stories, we would consider them insane. A lot of cases, we'd lock them up, and we'd probably reconsider the whole notion of Christianity.
Yeah, it might be that, like, when these ideas in the ancient world are sort of took root, and that they get perpetuated, but maybe because these conflict with modern notions of justice and fairness. Let's just take like the general idea that there's a reason why we can't quite understand and we couldn't grasp. I mean, that sort of abstract notion, quite apart from some of these other ideas, might is something that I think is still appealing to the modern mind. The idea that there's a reason. It's sort of like, think about like a magician, right? David Copperfield makes the Statue of Liberty disappear. You think, well, I know it's a trick, but I don't know how he did it, right? So the idea is that with God, there's a reason. It's just that I can't figure out what it is, but God's got a reason because he's God. So I wanted to hit a couple of attempts to explain or solve the problem of evil, a couple more. One is free will. And again, you don't have to necessarily go with the Garden of Eden story. And the Garden of Eden story has its own problems, because, like I said, I didn't vote for Adam. He's the one that disobeyed. I was born in sin. Or, is it a coincidence that every human being does wrong things? The biblical story says that the reason human beings sin is because they're descended from Adam. So it's sort of like if Lamarckianism is true. So this guy Lamarck had this idea that if you cut off a rat's tail, that the rat will give birth to children that will be missing tails. And it turns out that's not the case, right? That you can't, like, if something happens in the course of life to an animal, it doesn't pass on that change in it to its offspring. It's all in the genes. And so, but the idea is that Adam's kind of under a curse, and that this because Adam had the first act of disobedience, that he has then passed on that tendency to disobey God to all of his offspring. Well, why is that my fault?
So you wouldn't want to know anything and just be ignorant and not have any knowledge? I don't get it.
Well, why do you need to be a bad person to have knowledge? Because the knowledge of good and evil is what human beings got. So I guess the idea is beforehand they were innocent. The free will argument is that if God's going to create human beings, then a human being with a free will has the capacity to choose evil as well as good. So it's logically impossible for God to create free beings who will only do good. Without free will, we'd be like robots, and we'd do what we were programmed to do. That's not a free being. So it's no problem for omnipotence that God can't do the logically impossible, that God can't bake a cake that Professor Borrowdale baked all by himself, that God can't make a four-sided triangle. Those aren't even things. That's just nonsense. So the idea of making a free being who only does good, it's argued, is nonsense. And so because a world with free will is better than one without free will, and all the problems that it comes with, that therefore... evil is necessary. Yeah.
I think, in my opinion, this Judeo-Christian God is either, like you're saying, beyond the concept of good or evil, evil, or we don't understand the true nature of goodness that God could possess, because the Bible really paints this dark, like, malevolent picture of their God. I mean, they call him wrathful, but what does that really mean?
Well,
like, he's spiteful, and like, he takes pleasure from inflicting justice, which comes in the form of torture and pain and suffering of humans.
Well, I don't know if the God's portrayed as being delighted in human beings suffering.
Well, like,
he is portrayed as being angry and wrathful when human beings disobey him. That's
you look at the story of like Cain and Abel and like the offerings they gave to their God.
Uh-huh.
Abel presented God with livestock, which essentially can be interpreted as a blood sacrifice.
Yes, God wants blood sacrifices.
And so, like, I almost see, like, Cain's sacrifice of his brother as something that was accepted as an offering to God. And
I agree, you're playing the fast and loose story there.
Well,
the God, but whatever. It's true that God didn't want the vegetables. He wanted the blood. Yeah, that's why you had animal sacrifices are in the Old Testament. Why? To appease God's anger. Let me just make sure we get all these in the spiritual development theodicy. And this is, people have talked about this idea that we need to evolve and grow over time. And suffering is sort of that way that we learn. That you learn something really well when something really bad happens, when you try to do something or when you make a big mistake. You think, oh, I'm never going to make that mistake again. And one thing you might think is like, well, why do you need to grow and develop in the first place? Why didn't God just create the way he wanted you? Why did God create ready-made saints? Right? If God wants you to be morally perfect, why didn't you create you then in the first place, like that in the first place? And if we need to grow and develop to become saints, to be fitted for heaven, then what's God going to do in heaven? If free will, and this kind of goes back to free will, if free will is necessary in order to allow the freedom to do evil, what's going to keep people from sinning once they get to heaven, or once God's heaven comes on earth? Seems like you never have the sort of heaven that's promised, or there has to be some constraint on free will in order to keep people from sinning. Well, why didn't God just do that in the first place? But the spiritual development, the Odyssey, just says that God needs to put you through suffering in order for you to develop spiritually in a certain way. But the question is why. Why does he have to develop you if he wanted you a certain way? Why did he skip the rigmarole of the process and make you like that to begin with? Yeah.
The weird thing, too, is, like, we're God's favorite, correct? Like, we are the epitome of his creation, and we were revered above all other creation.
Yeah, according to the sort of biblical stories,
and
right?
And that's why Lucifer fell, is because he wouldn't worship man.
That's a crazy Mormon variation, but Lucifer fell, and I think it's in the Quran too. Lucifer fell just because he wanted to be like God. But anyway, it's a side story. But
okay. I suppose like Mormons.
How does that happen if Lucifer
Islam
didn't have free will?
Well, I think the idea is that Lucifer did have free will, so he rebelled against God.
I thought the angels did have free will.
No, I think that there. I mean, there might be a question about why, like, the angels in heaven don't sin, I suppose. So they don't have the freedom not to sin. Or think about God himself, that's a problem too, right? If God has free will, does he have the ability to sin? If he doesn't have the ability to sin, then it seems like he's not omnipotent, right? Because there are certain things God can't do, namely evil things. Well, that means he's not really all-powerful. And then we have the human ignorance theodicy, those three attempted solutions to the problem of evil. And I think... Oh, me, I'm good, okay. So I think we're going to leave it there. We'll probably talk a little bit about this at the beginning of class and then move on to the meaning of life on Tuesday. Oh, the X-ray essay, I'm still working on those. I'll probably finish those this weekend.